The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hey, this is Annie.
And Samantha.
And welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You, a production of iHeartRadio. So, quick trigger warning for this one. We are going to be talking about some violence, some trauma, some sexual assault, some sexual violence issues. We're not going to go too deeply in them, but they are kind of part of the plots of the movies we're talking about today. So if that is not something that you're in a good space for or want to hear right now, totally get you. And come back later or, you know, don't if it's just never going to be your thing. That's totally cool. So yes, in our ongoing tradition of choosing unconventional holiday movies in December for our Feminist Movie Fridays, we're doing a double feature on Black Christmas, which I actually didn't know there was another
version. A third one.
Yeah. We could have done a triple feature. I don't know if we could have handled it.
I don't think I would have been ready for that.
No, but I had no idea there was another one out there. So we're doing the original and then 2019 one. So like the original one and the newest one.
Right.
The one in the middle we're skipping.
I gave a little bit of a synopsis in my run through.
Perfect. I read about it because people were comparing kind of the differences in the way they handle some of these issues in all three of them. So I did read about it a little bit. So we'll talk about it. I saw the original Black Christmas when I was in college, I think, and I found it highly disturbing. I still found it pretty disturbing on rewatch. It wasn't as disturbing, but I think this time I knew more of what I was going to get into.
Right.
Whereas the first time, I don't think I expected a lot of what happened in that movie.
Yeah. First time for me for both of those. I've never watched either one. I don't think I was aware of it until a year or two ago. And we had a listener who was like, you should watch Black Christmas, the newer version. Especially when we were talking about all of the travesties that were happening under the last administration, including Kavanaugh and all of that, which is fitting for the first movie as well as the second movie, but I found that interesting. It was a suggestion. We were like, okay, let's do it. Let's do it. It's out on HBO Max, the newest version. The other version is on Peacock, if that so interests you.
Neither of them are sponsors currently.
No, neither none of them, but if you're trying to find this movie.
Yes.
For me, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because I'm just agitated and it's that time of year or what. But I'm like, at some points, and I've gotten to this in several movies and like thriller situations or moments of like, oh, don't go in there. You're going to die. I'm like, yeah, you deserve to die. I definitely had a couple of moments with them. I'm like, yeah, you deserve to die. That's on you. I have no sympathy, apparently. But yes, it was the first one was definitely a lot more disturbing to me than the second one and a little more cohesive. But we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, this was my first time watching the second one. And I'm actually glad I always do this. I research it before I watch it. I'm actually glad I did this for that one. Although, All right, spoiler alert, I guess. If you want to see that one, you haven't seen it. Spoiler alert, we are going to be talking about it.
Oh, we're going to talk about the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. I did a lot of reading before I watched the new one. So I knew what it was all about, which I actually think was great. But I somehow, either I misread something or somebody was being satirical and I misinterpreted it, or they were incorrect. But they said hardly anyone died in the new one. So
what?
Yes. So I was watching it like, oh, this is kind of nice to know, like, everyone's going to be fine. And then everyone very much was not fine. And it kept happening to the point I was like, wait.
Like, immediately, the beginning scene is a death.
I know. The whole movie, I was just getting more and more confused and thinking maybe it's all, what is this? I have been lied to.
You had been lied to.
Yes. It was an interesting viewing experience for sure. Okay, but let's start with the old one. The original Black Christmas is a 1974 Canadian slasher movie produced and directed by Bob Clark of A Christmas Story and written by A. Roy Moore. Clark wanted to portray smarter young adults compared to what was often the norm in U.S. horror movies, saying, quote, college students, even in 1974, are astute people. They're not fools. It's not all bikinis, beach blankets, and bingo.
And which makes me laugh, because he's also the director of Porky's, which is exactly that stereotype he's talking about.
I did not know that. Okay.
Yes.
upon rewatching this movie, I found it to be like the most 70s. It was originally called Silent Night, Evil Night in the U.S. to avoid concerns that it was a blaxploitation film. It stars Margot Kidder, Olivia Hussey, who allegedly accepted the role because of a psychic, Andrea Martin, Lynn Griffin, Marion Waldman, Keir DeLay, and John Saxon. It is loosely based on the urban legend of the babysitter and the man upstairs. You know, the call is coming from inside the house, that thing. It's also rumored to have been inspired by a series of murders around Montreal that took place during the holiday season in 1943. And unfortunately, the television premiere in 1978 was marred by a double murder at a Florida sorority house.
Yeah, so the 1978 murders they're talking about is the Bundy murders that happened, which is a fairly big case because there was actually survivors in that case. But also, just for those who don't know, Margot Kidder is Lois in the Superman and all of the probably the more successful of Supermans with Christopher Reeves. And Andrea Martin is the aunt from My Big Fat Greek Wedding. I love her. Love her. And seeing her in this role, I was like, what? What?
Oh.
Just want to put that out there.
Okay. Interesting. So the plot follows a group of sorority girls and their drunk sorority house mother. Unbeknownst to them, a mysterious man climbs into the attic while they're having a Christmas party. The man calls and Jess, one of the sorority girls, answers and hears strange noises and obscene words on the other end. She gathers the other sorority girls in the house around the phone to listen, and one of them insults the man who promises to kill her. One of the other girls, Claire, worries that the man may be dangerous and goes to bed. The killer strangles her and drags her body to the attic. When her father, Mr. Harrison, arrives to pick her up in the morning, she is nowhere to be found. So he reports her missing to the police, only to discover another girl recently went missing when walking home. Meanwhile, Jess tells her boyfriend that she is pregnant and intends to get an abortion. This infuriates him, and Jess convinces him that they will discuss it later. Determined to find his daughter and the missing girl, Mr. Harrison returns to the sorority house and helps the girls there put one of their drunk sisters to bed, Barb. At the same time, the house mother finds Claire's body in the attic. The man kills her by throwing a hook in her face and hanging her. The missing girl's body is found disfigured in the park. At the house, Jess gets another obscene phone call and decides to file a police report. Her boyfriend arrives and attempts to convince her that they should get married. She refuses and tells him again she is planning to get an abortion. He leaves in a huff just as the police arrive to bug the phone line. After the police leave, the killer murders the drunk sister with a glass figurine of a unicorn, perhaps one of the ultimate symbols of innocence of young girls. Jess picks up another call from the killer, who repeats the conversation she had with her boyfriend, scaring her because it's implying he's nearby. But Lieutenant Fuller, who is in charge of watching the phone line, calls to tell her they failed at tracing the call, but that he suspects it could be her boyfriend Peter behind it. Jess does not agree. Another girl is murdered. The killer calls again and tells Jess a story about two children named Agnes and Billy who did something wrong. The police trace the call and tell Jess to leave immediately because it is coming from inside the house. Jess goes to check on the other occupants of the house. She doesn't want to leave them behind, where she finds two bodies. The killer attacks her and Jess flees to the cellar. Peter shows up outside the window, breaking the glass to get into the basement. The police show up to find Jess screaming and barely conscious, with Peter kind of bloody next to her. And Jess just seems like so out of it. The police believe that Peter is the culprit. So they are like, okay, this is done. They put Jess to bed with a cop standing outside, but we hear the voice of the killer coming from the attic, implying it wasn't Peter, and the killer is still alive and still there. The bodies of the house mother and Claire are in the attic, yet to be found, and the phone rings. End of movie. It's got a really ambiguous ending.
It did. Yes. Is there a sequel? I did wonder that.
I don't think there's a sequel. There's been, yeah, like the, from what I understand, the one we're not really going to be talking about kind of digs into the killer more and why he is the way he is. But yeah, I don't think there was ever a sequel. And this is kind of notorious for having like one of these, the most ambiguous endings ever.
Right.
Okay.
You never know. You never see his face.
Yeah, you don't know if she's going to survive. It is kind of, and we're going to talk about this, it is very kind of frustrating and a little funny. It's like, the bodies are right there.
Right.
Where he is.
Right.
In the attic. The police clearly have not done a good job searching this house.
They do not. Yeah, this is the massive amount of like, no one's seen this body. No one's going to check on it. No one's going to do a search of the house. No? Oh. Cool.
Especially after she found two bodies in there, I would think you would be like, I wonder if the other bodies are also in here.
Right. Although one of them, they don't know is dead. The house mother.
That's true. That's true. Because she was like leaving for a trip.
Right. Right. They all assume she'd already left.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. That is true.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands. Not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC. So when this movie first got released, it got mixed reviews, but has since been reappraised, and it definitely has a cult following. It's been praised for the influence it had on John Carpenter's 1978 film, The Thing, and the film Halloween, and is thought to be one of the first slasher movies and one of the first examples of the final girl. and one of the best horror movies of all time. So that's quite a shift from like, meh, to now people are like, it's one of the best. And I just wanted to say this because it made me laugh. A Season's Grievings edition was later released.
Oh, yeah.
Here are a sampling of some of the negative reviews it got when it came out. It is notable only for indicating the kind of junk roles that talented actresses are forced to play in the movies. And that's from the Chicago Tribune. And, quote, before it maddeningly overreaches in a gratuitously evasive ending, Black Christmas, opening today at selected theaters, is a smart, stylish, Canadian-made little horror picture that is completely diverting. It may well be that its makers simply couldn't figure out how to end it. And that's from the Los Angeles Times. But yeah, people were frustrated with the ending. They were like, but wait. However, it has, yes, spawned some remakes since then.
Yeah, so we decided to compare it to the 2019 version of Black Christmas, which is a bit of an on-the-nose take about woke culture, but there was a previous remake that was made in 2007, which Bob Clark did executive produce, and it followed along the theory of the killers being Agnes and Billy, who was abused by his mother, by their mother. But again, yes, for the 2019 movie, we have a different take with a bit more supernatural element to it. And yeah, the 2007 is loosely also based on the original. That's what they say. So they took the whole story and made it their own. But it did have some horrifying abuse segues.
Yeah.
The 2019 movie was cast and planned soon after Blumhouse Productions' founder made this comment. There are not a lot of female directors, period. Even less who are inclined to do horror. So this was his idea of like why, this was his answer to why he doesn't have a lot of female directors as a part of his company or that is a part of any of the movie making. And of course, that got a lot of backlash. And so soon after, he decided to go to this route, which, by the way, again, is a real on-the-nose cautionary tale, I guess, or like kind of a revenge movie for all of the sexism that exists, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So when you look at the list of big honchos, though, in the movie credits, it's still very male-driven. Very. Like, I was waiting for any other female names. There weren't many. So, okay. So the film was directed by Sofia Takal and it was written by Takal and April Wolf. And they took this movie in a new script and brought on a new set of sorority sisters from MKE. Mu Kappa Epsilon, I believe, is a made-up sorority. And we have Riley Stone, played by Imogen Poots, Chris, played by Elise Shannon, Marty, played by Lily Donahue, Jesse, played by Brittany O'Grady, Helena, played by Madeline Adams, and Fran, played by Natalie Morris. Now, we're really going to be more so concentrating on Riley and Chris, so don't get too caught up in all of these because the rest die. Spoiler alert.
Yeah, sure so. Do. Despite what
just
I read.
In case you needed to know. So we begin the movie with the opening scene following a young sorority girl getting ready to go home during Christmas break. But we have that eerie moment of watching her being followed by a man who seems a bit too close. At the same time, she's receiving messages from a profile of the founder of Hawthorne College, Calvin Hawthorne, which is where they're at, who we quickly realize as it begins with a quote from him, is a sexist jerk. And much like many other horror movies, after an intense cat and mouse chase scene, she's immediately murdered by a hooded masked figure with an icicle.
Yeah.
That's always been a thing. I'm like, there you go. The murder weapon's
gone.
A few years later, we see the main ladies of the movie, but there is a nice camaraderie among the women preparing for the holiday festivities and just overall friendship. And just how I kind of talked about in the game that I really love, there's this like, you can tell women wrote this in the fact that they're like, we actually like our female friends. I don't know where this narrative came from that we're all competing with each other. So it was really nice to see because immediately when you think of sorority culture, kind of like the old version of Black Christmas, they had two women having an argument with each other and not liking each other's lifestyles, essentially. But you don't really have that in this one. So that's kind of nice to see. But there is a dark cloud that seems to be looming over Riley, who we know has lost both her parents and doesn't want to participate in the yearly holiday singing, which she did the year before and apparently was really good at it. We move on to see them in class where we see Carrie Elwes, Princess Bride fame. Yes, I had a huge crush on him. Playing Professor Gelson, who seems to be heavily implying that women could not be uplifted without first having men being uplifted. And if men were to fall from their power structure, it would only make the whole system fail and destroy everything. There is a bit of an intense back and forth where Riley is singled out, and we find out that there's a petition against Professor Gelson for his misogynistic and sexist teaching and overall attitudes towards his students, led by her sorority sister and friend, Chris. Mm-hmm. Yes, the other one that survives. Spoiler alert. So the night is the night of the big event before Christmas break, and the fraternity hosting the event is riddled with toxic fraternity traits, including rape and overall disgusting behaviors. Riley prevents a sexual assault from happening to a sister, in which we hear the dude calling them bitches and teases, of course. Mm-hmm. She also witnesses some type of ceremony where the bust of the founder, which was removed due to a protest led by Chris, is crying black goo, and all the people are in robes and masks. And yes, this is a secret ceremony, y'all. Mm-hmm. Due to the sister being either drunk or drugged, the one she helped and prevented being assaulted, or both, she goes home. Riley has to take her place in this little musical number, and it is soon revealed that Riley had been drugged and raped by a former member of that frat, and though she had reported it, they didn't move forward due to not believing her. Of course not. And of course, he is present for that night, though he had already graduated, and he's welcomed back with open arms. And the entire song, which is at the end credit, by the way, if you needed a remastered version, is pretty much talking about that assault and the toxic culture of the frat. Makes them very angry, the frat. Yeah. And all these things. And she gets her courage and faces off with him during this performance, again, calling out the rape culture and about the incident. And then they run back to the sorority house. And soon after, the girls start disappearing. And even though Riley is concerned, no one seems to believe her. No one. Mm-hmm. No one, including her own housemates. I'm still baffled by this. And she makes a report, but the campus security seems skeptical, saying 9 times out of 10, girls are just off with their boyfriends, which, by the way, is a throwback to the 1974 version. And then even comes out with a classic line, boys will be, and he kind of trails off. So, you know, she tries to investigate the frat house for her friend, but is confronted by the professor, and she runs away after it's being revealed that their performance went viral, which starts an argument between Chris and Riley, where it's revealed that all the ladies are getting weird, threatening DMs from this Calvin Hawthorne. We then see the ultimate fight scene in which two more of the sisters are killed, as well as one of the sisters' boyfriends, who seems to be having headaches and acting unlike himself. Yeah. And very masculine, by the way. This is why he died. He's like, I must protect the people. I am a man.
Yes.
Really.
They're
killed by the same hooded masked individual who for some reason now has a bow and arrow. Mm-hmm. Riley and Chris are able to kill their assailant, only to find another one coming at them. Something to note, Riley kills one of them with a key trick so many women use when in fear while walking alone in parking lots or the such. I thought that was a nice touch. Turns out one of the people killed is the dude Riley saw getting initiated into that secret ceremony, and he seemed possessed, as in he didn't bleed blood, but black goo. Here we see Riley and Chris argue again, Riley taking things into her own hands to go after the frat, while Chris tries to leave, but comes up on another sorority house that's also being attacked. She helps them escape from the same masked hooded monsters. And by the way, this new sorority is the original sisters for the first person that died in the movie.
Yes,
so they kind of knew something was happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. I was like, what's happening? Oh, yeah. So that's what happened. So coming back to Riley, she and her pink shovel that she brought from her home are heading to the frat, run into Crush Landon, who we met earlier, who insists on helping her. And then when she arrives at the fraternity, she finds Helena, who she thought was dead and she was trying to report as missing, but seemed to have been kidnapped by the frat. At that point, Riley is knocked out, but was able to see Helena smile as she goes into unconsciousness, a rut-row. Mm-hmm. When she wakes up, she's tied up at the same secret place where she saw the ceremony take place and is surrounded by others in hoods and masks. And Landon, who also puts on a hood and mask, the crush who came with her, but he's in a trance. And we learn that the frat has superpowers to turn all the men into alphas and possessing them through goo.
Yes.
Through the goo misogynistic Hawthorne. And they're all being led by Professor Gelson and her rapist, who is determined to dominate her and punish her for dragging his name through the mud, he says. Helena is trying to make her see that this is natural and submission and compliance were the only way to make the world better. But then she dies violently at the hands of the supernaturally strong brothers.
Yep.
So whoopsie. Riley says that she will comply only to attack Brian, the rapist who attempts to murder her. But Chris and the other ladies of the sorority come through fighting again with bows and arrows and then anything else they can find. Uh-huh. And apparently one of them is really good with it. So hey. Yeah. Riley is able to fight off Brian, break the bus, and fight against the rest of the frat. Chris then lights the professor on fire, and the ladies and Landon, who is no longer possessed, run out, lock the rest of the frat boys to burn to death. Yes. Like the original, there were aspects of looking at the issues at hand, taking apart some of the societal implications of that time. Again, it may be a little too heavy-handed. Maybe I'm just being cynical.
No, that was the big critique everybody had. And that's why I say I'm glad I knew that going in, because I actually think it helped me enjoy it more, because I knew, like, literally everything I read said it's really heavy-handed.
Yeah, it really was. I think the conversation of smashing white supremacy and the misogyny and sexism on campus was a key point throughout the movie and the subject of toxic fraternity culture during a time of the Kavanaugh confirmation, which was in headlines at that point and very familiar to many who've been in this situation or like around that situation. And we've talked about it and it's still talked about, like, all of that toxicity within specifically those types of fraternities. Now, again, I think there was so much they're trying to cram pack into a movie like this, and it was hard to get at any point where it didn't feel like it was beating you over the head. And I say this in that they almost villainized Chris, who is one of the few women of color in this movie, and to have her being like the angry person of color seemed so tropish. I was like, wow, y'all couldn't pick any... No, but okay. It seemed very much white feminist take to this person of color. I'm pointing to myself now, but maybe I'm just being too cynical again. However, yeah, the majority of critics, as you were saying, yeah, they weren't great. They were not. The criticisms were not great. So many reviews were mixed, as the script seemed to have a great idea, but not so great execution. That was one of the thoughts from one reviewer. In part, Tikal wanted to keep the rating PG-13 to be more accessible for a younger crowd, but may have lost some of the depth of the movie as it passed through it without too many memorable moments in it. And they did talk about, like, the deaths were so, like, the characters were so underdeveloped that it didn't really affect us when people died, which I will say one of my biggest concern was I didn't want Chris to die, of course not. I also didn't want the cat to die, which, by the way, there's a cat in both this 2019 version and the 1974 version that does push the plot along. That's how two of the characters died, essentially, was because of the cat. I feel like that was purposeful and kind of an homage. So there is that. But yeah, there you go. 2019 version of Black Christmas.
Yeah, it's very different. There are a lot of themes are there, and we're going to talk about them, but it's very different. I did. There were parts of it I really liked, and I thought a lot of the shots were really good, like really pretty. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I also thought, and I think we're going to talk about this, but they kind of, the way they handled the whole sexual assault thing was a little triggering, because there'd be flashbacks, but also just how... I don't think it was necessarily healthy how they talked about it and how all of her friends were like, basically, you've got to get over it. You've got to face it. Get over it.
I think that was the other part. It's like the friend Chris, when I say they villainized her because of this, I really feel like that's just what they did with her. And I could get to a point of like, when we talk about social justice warriors and the negativity of like, you, why aren't you telling your story loudly? Mm-hmm. You need to advocate. And you're like, that's not how I do it. You don't know my trauma. So we do see that.
Yeah,
but yet each one of them forces her into a way that they're like, people don't cope the same way. And this didn't happen to you. So this is really irresponsible for you to make that your battleground, that this is your hill when it's not.
Right.
And I'm like, this is not being good friendships. This is not good. And it felt weird too at the end when she apologizes. Riley, the survivor, is apologizing to her friend for not being stronger. I'm like, wait. That sent the whole different message when you did this. Why did you do this?
I thought that too. I thought that was pretty damaging for kind of the arc to be, she had to get the courage and be brave enough to face her assaulter. But that scene is like a positive, like healing is great.
Right.
But nothing about that was like her choice and her,
right.
Like, it wasn't a healthy thing that, and plus
none
there's
of this
murder.
Was healthy. Right. So. There's murder. There's no therapy. There's nothing other than we need to sign this petition and fight. And again, I get that kind of thought process to a certain extent. And perhaps we're seeing something that wasn't what T'Call had originated. This is not the movie that she wanted. I don't know. I'm not seeing anything written in her reactions to this. Because from what I understand, her Hulu series or her episode in the Hulu series was really great. She got praise. I think New Year, New You is the one. Yeah, that makes me wonder what was originated, what was the thought process. It makes me think, this is almost performative from the male gaze. Maybe that's just whole thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get into the themes.
Yeah. We'll get into it. All right. So one of the big ones is harassment, which we do see in both of them. And in the original, the killer is often described as psychosexual, someone who primarily targets girls and women. And when he kills Claire, who's the first person he kills, he puts a baby doll in her lap and kind of rocks her, and it's this act of infantilization and perceived inferiority of women. Clark claims to have a backstory for the killer. Quote, Billy is abusive and abused his little sister and was abused himself and probably killed his parents and probably locked her up in a basement for 5 or 6 years. And I think she escaped, and Billy doesn't like girls, and it turns out Agnes doesn't like boys. We've talked about like stigma around mental health and abuse and trauma. And so that's kind of an example of that. You really don't get any of that. Like you kind of, it's hard to understand what he's saying on the phone.
Right. That felt very ableist. The rocking and then the overreacting when he kills the house mother. Mm-hmm. It was a weird like moment of what's happening. His constant bumbling and grumbling and groaning instead of actual words. It felt very, it was uncomfortable. You're like, why did you have to do all this?
Yeah. Yeah. It's unsettling. And another thing, many of the deaths are filmed through the killer's gaze, which we have talked about before, about how that can be problematic in terms of like who the audience is connecting with.
Right.
Yeah. And why?
Right. I thought also with the harassment, I thought it was something to note, the fact that one had the phone calls, like landlined, and the two landlines in one little house versus the DMs, and the fact that having to explain to the security guard what a DM is. I thought that was really kind of funny. I was like, okay, is that where we are?
Yes. Well, it is interesting because people have said that. People have said, like when we talked about cyber stalking, that was something people said that was kind of a roadblock for them, is that they had to explain these technologies to authorities. Another thing that we see in these, victim blaming. At the beginning of the original film, one of the girls says, "You can't rape a townie."
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to lie. I gasped at that.
Yeah.
Because that was one of the things at the very beginning. You know something troubling has happened around campus and there are some rapes, and they talked about we need to take this phone call seriously, which was really disturbing, really sexually aggressive messaging at the first phone call. Mm-hmm. And then they say that and you're like, ah.
Yeah.
Excuse me? Which is a whole different conversation. Yeah. And in the 2019 version, it's not so much the victim blaming, just more of women not being believed. And again, the boys being boys statement and, you know, being alpha statement, that's a whole different conversation. But it was more so like the fact that the other girls weren't concerned. We're like, we should all be concerned. Why aren't you not believing each other, not listening to each other, and not respecting each other's boundaries. There was a lot of that. And I was like, why?
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely much more of a, it doesn't matter. We don't believe you. yeah. It was pretty infuriating. Then there's a lot of dismissing of women. speaking of, when the girls first report their concerns in the original one, the police dismiss them, not believing them to be true. When Claire is reported missing, they assume she's off somewhere with her boyfriend, which, yes, that quote is in both. They ask if she drinks a lot, if she's seeing someone else. They don't explore the house and don't find all the bodies. And also, I did laugh at that. Is it like Claire's boyfriend who's like got all his fur or something, and he's so serious faced, and he shows up like to the police office, and then they're like, oh, okay, now we'll pay attention. But he's like, this is an outrage.
Right. I think it's interesting that it took a dead body for them to take it seriously, for sure. Mm-hmm. When we've already talked about that rape has happened, so that's an interesting. And again, we talked about the security guard being dismissive, the women being dismissive of each other and just kind of disregarding each other's boundaries and feelings and whatnot, which causes for all the arguments as well. Yeah, definitely a big theme of the movie.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Tennessee just sounds perfect, whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands. Not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC. And then I wanted to talk about, because I feel like almost everything I read mentioned this, but Jess in the original version has this sweater. It's just like two skeleton hands over her boobs. And somehow
I didn't even notice it.
Oh, like I didn't notice it the first time I watched it. And then I read all this stuff about it. I was like, what? And then when you see it, you can't unsee it.
Oh.
Yeah. And so a lot of people have interpreted that as like the male gaze or like this male touch or this patriarchy dragging her back. Like it's just like hands on her. At all times, which I thought that was really interesting. It's quite the striking sweater. And then there's Claire. I didn't notice this the first time either, but Claire's posters, she has kind of these, you know, they're not like too sexual, but like sexual posters in her room. And it's sort of like a gasping moment of her dad's like, I didn't send her here for this. But it's interesting because she's the first to die, despite the assumption she's a virgin. There's a quote in there, quote, she's a good girl, which normally would put you in final girl / safe territory. But she's the first to go in this one.
But that's interesting that the two women who are pitted against each other as the virginal and the slut, the virginal one has the risque stuff and the slut has the unicorn and the young girl innocent stuff. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that was meant to be. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. I bet it was. And then, yes, there's a lot of themes around assault, especially in the second one. Yeah, especially in the second one. So, yeah, just like this whole idea, probably just had her boyfriends and that's fine. The boys will be boys thing. And when we say it's on the nose, it's on the nose because literally that I can't remember her name, but the guy who is like having migraines and kind of acting strange, yeah. the boyfriend, he literally says at one point, I like beer. And
right.
It's so like, oh yeah, Brett Kavanaugh.
Right. But it was so interesting because this was the moment where he's been being brainwashed mm-hmm. and he walks in, he's getting more and more aggressive as it goes. And they're trying to figure out why, which mm-hmm. is so unlike him. And then he's drinking beer and her reaction was, you don't even like beer. He's like, I like beer. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, what? And so both of those tropes are like, oh, this is obviously a Kavanaugh reference, as well as the fact that we talked about how men like beer. If they don't, they're not manly. And so that was his beginning of like, I'm an alpha male, obviously, because I'm drinking beer.
Right.
A little on the nose on that one.
Yeah, I was a little confused. I got it, but I was also like, this feels kind of out of nowhere. But at this point, you don't know about the whole goo misogyny thing that's brainwashing right. them. So I don't know.
Right.
And then we also discussed this kind of problematic narrative throughout the new one of the responsibility to share your story and to share your story in a certain way. I thought this line was interesting at one point. I think Chris says we could make a list of the guys who want us dead. Which right. is, every now and then I take a step back and I think about the walking to the car with the keys or all these things that we do in our everyday that's kind of in the back of your head. You're thinking, I could be killed or I could be raped or something. Like,
right.
Those threats just live there. And we kind of have gotten used to them.
Right. And especially for those who actually take a stand or be mm-hmm. like one of those who do fend for themselves, literally are like, hey, I'm not going to take this. The amount of people who, yeah. But when she says that so dismissively as if it's like common yep. thing, it's also like, oh God. Oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, like I said, definitely not believing women. There's also kind of a not leaving other women behind thing in both. I'm not sure how successfully it was pulled off, but there's kind of this idea of like, yeah, we're stronger together. We stick together. Yeah. So that was there. I did want to briefly talk about the abortion part from the 1974 one, because the first time I saw this, it kind of shocked me. I was like,
yeah.
Whoa. Jess's boyfriend calls her a selfish bitch when she says she wants an abortion. And interestingly, Jess is never really portrayed villainously for this decision. Her boyfriend, mm-hmm. Peter, is instead portrayed as a villain, as a violent, angry man who's trying to control her. Also interestingly, while Jess is a final girl, she doesn't quite fit this trope because she's very open about her active sex life. The movie was released soon after abortion became legal in both the U.S. and Canada. Damn, that's so interesting. I feel like you don't really see that in a lot of movies.
You don't see that as a plot point spoken yeah. so normally. Especially.
Right, exactly.
Like, it's not such a big deal for anyone else. And there's no one else who's like, oh my God, this is a baby. Like, it's him who right. is acting like a child and not understanding the level of responsibility. And then you have her who's just straightforward, like, hey, no, I can't do this. I don't love you like that.
Yeah.
It is interesting because especially when we talk about the waves of feminism and how it came through, they were so much more accepting. Sminty has talked about it before, about the fact that it wasn't that big and it wasn't this huge morality thing until later on, much yeah. you know, later in history than you would expect. And mm-hmm. I think this might have hit that time, weirdly
yeah.
enough.
Yeah, and so for us, it feels, or at least, right. yeah, it felt weird to me. I'm like, wow, they're just talking about it, and it's not like the right. main plot point, but it's a plot point, and it's like, she's not bad.
right.
She's not being painted in a negative light for it. And it's not some huge, like, drama. it's just
right.
her kind of being annoyed with this guy and being very matter-of-fact.
Essentially.
Like, yeah.
and maybe he's a killer. Who knows?
And maybe he's a killer. But either way, you're not meant to sympathize with him.
No.
and then I watched both of these back-to-back, which was interesting because I kind of, there's like this idea of this nameless, faceless killer. And it kind of feels like in both of them that could represent these ideas we're talking about of like misogyny and patriarchy of like at the end of the old one, they probably didn't get the guy. It's going to continue. And of course, in the newer one, misogyny being like this goo, this kind of thing that people right. are just absorbing. Yeah, it was interesting also, like, I remember, I think it was in the second one where there was a part where I was like, so are they kind of saying not all men equals all men?
Right. I mean, the 2019 version literally has the argument of the not all men because Marty, the boyfriend who was like, I like beer, starts screaming at her about, you lump us all in, we can't win, and you're telling us we're all the bad guys. And she was just like, what is happening with you? But essentially, he is being that voice of saying that feminism has caused the villainization of all men. And this is your fault.
But then he became
I thought that was interesting.
All men.
They did, because that's what they wanted to do. So it'll be a little less on the nose on that one. And like, see, we told you, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. But a part of that, too, is that the newer one was definitely big on, like, all of this news stories around sexual assault on college campuses and Me Too and frat culture.
Right. Again, yeah, a big theme is the heavy hitting of woke culture. And I don't think they ever say woke in that. I don't think that term had been so big at that point in time. But it is. It's definitely in there. And then the not necessarily a critique, but again, heavy-handed themes where there was no way. It was being said every few minutes about white supremacy, the patriarchy. And again, sounds like some of our conversations sometimes, Annie. Yeah. I mean, we definitely do live in that world. So not so outside of the realms of it, but for a horror movie, it's kind of like, what? Oh, okay, okay, okay. But again, it's also portrayed by the one who could be seen and disliked because she was too forceful. And I say this in that it seemed like it was a stereotypical casting in what they were doing and how they were representing it and putting it all on one woman, which seemed weird. I'm like, that's not how that's it. Okay, cool. Again, the constant need to fight, quote unquote, whether it's through a petition, a song, or literally with knives and bows and arrows. So like that is definitely a heavy-handed theme. At one point, one of the critiques about this movie stated that they felt like they were trying to do a Get Out, meaning they wanted to do a very on-topical type of movie, but just kind of was so overboard that it didn't balance. And I could see that. Riley as the final girl. But here we actually have two in the two different manners, except one is singled out as a victim out for revenge, and the other is a social justice warrior who runs but comes back to save her friend after she finds backup, essentially. Like, she finds her crew of people who are ready to fight as well. So I thought that was interesting. But yeah, there was a lot to this movie that I'm like, I see where you're going.
Yeah.
I think if you had 4 hours long, could really like build some character and depth in these characters, rather, it would have gone a lot further. But they're trying to make it a slasher horror movie of what it was originally with all the social commentary and not just one or two things, but so much. And granted, 2019, 2016, 2020, 2021, every month probably could be a two-hour movie. Let's just be real. Any of those years, each month could be a movie in itself. So I get like there was a lot to try to cram in there, especially when we want to talk about, it's kind of like one of my episodes when I'm like, here, I'm going to talk about this one thing, and then I've trailed off into 10 other subjects that could be in its own
episode. We do that a lot.
So I get it. But yeah, it's definitely one of those like, yes, I understand this. Yes. And maybe also, Annie, on this note, with you and I as both being women who've experienced sexual trauma, myself as being a person of color, this is like, yeah, I already know. So maybe that's why it felt so on the nose, because for us, this is, the truth of it. And there's nothing different for us.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. It's one of those weird things where like seeing something like that, if it's done well, is nice. Even if it's like, oh, I can tell women have done this. I just remember so clearly that moment in Birds of Prey where they asked about the hair band or something. And I'm like, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
So it's like, I'm glad to see those things acknowledged, especially when we know, you know, who wrote it and are people who have experienced it. But yeah, you're right. Maybe because maybe other people watched it and were like, what? I've definitely had those conversations with male friends in my life where I'm like, oh yeah, the keys, you know?
Right.
And they don't know. And I think for me, it just felt like too much was trying to be done, but also, and this also could be very much because we're in this realm, but the whole sexual assault thing, I was like, this was not handled well.
No.
It just wasn't handled well. And it felt, to me, as someone who's experienced it, and I don't want to say anything about anybody on the, because I don't know, but for me, as someone who's experienced it, I was like, this just feels incorrect. It doesn't feel like a healthy way of showing this. But
well, I think the other part to that was when we see the original Helena, who's getting assaulted, mm-hmm. and she's trying to prevent this. And then she comes back to the group and just literally says, you know, she's just drunk. It's kind of like, are we not going to talk about whether or not she might have been drugged? Which y'all have already said they do.
Yeah.
Like, and they were so dismissive and point her as if she was like, Helena, of course, and not seeing an issue with mm-hmm. this moment. As the victim herself, the survivor herself, Riley, she is triggered. So she notices it and she's triggered. They show it a little bit. But then the dismissiveness of it is like, this is a weird glazing over of a really volatile, traumatic moment. I don't understand.
Yeah. So there were just some things like that. We didn't even really get to talk about in that whole betrayal of...
Yeah, we didn't. And I feel like I get it too, but here's this other part of like, okay, we gotta have the you know, we're not gonna say all women either, but here's this one woman who wants to be subjugated to the, I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah. That part kind of threw me that I was like, I guess she's being possessed, but it just feels, it doesn't
fit. I don't think she was possessed.
I thought she was. It doesn't fit with her character at all. I thought, I was like, okay.
She came back and was like, thank you so much for my pen, the hair comb. And then it comes back. She's like, don't you see? They gave me a choice and they can give you a choice. And if we give in, we'll be okay because they're going to take over the world anyway. But this feels right. Doesn't this feel right? I don't think she was possessed. I don't think she was supposed to be.
Well, what is that called? There's a name for that when you think you get a choice, but there's no choice. But the power of tricking people into thinking there's a choice.
Right.
Then we're getting into way too deep of topics for this.
So many things, y'all.
So let's end it here. We hope that you enjoyed this. I think they were both worth watching, to be honest. But yeah, it's some interesting things, problematic things. As is in most things we talk about.
True.
Yes. And always keep those suggestions coming. What should we watch next? Ooh. You can email us at stuffmediamomstuff@iheartmedia.com. You can find us on Twitter at Momstuff Podcast or on Instagram at Stuff I Never Told You. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Christina.
Yes, thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. Stuff I Never Told You is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeartRadio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.